You look at a skyscraper and think, you know, I own a piece of that brick and mortar.
Right, yeah.
But the moment you buy a digital property token, well, that physical brick just sort of vanishes into the ether.
It really does.
So today we're doing a deep dive into the source material, the legal architecture of tokenized property ownership, to basically find out what your crypto actually buys you in the real world.
Yeah, and it's an important question for you, the listener, to understand.
Exactly. Okay, let's unpack this. Because the core friction we are seeing right now is that people are approaching this entirely new technology with a fundamentally antiquated mindset.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, they are buying a digital token on a decentralized network and genuinely believing they are buying a literal brick in a building. Like they think they hold the deed to the lobby or maybe the roof.
Yeah, but the reality outlined in our source material is highly abstracted.
Right.
It's deeply layered and honestly a lot more complex than just putting a house on the blockchain.
Putting a house on the blockchain, right?
Yeah. What's fascinating here is that the rights you acquire when you buy into this space are not informal. They aren't these decentralized promises just floating around on a distributed ledger.
Like some kind of crypto honor system.
Exactly. They are strictly defined legal, financial, and governance rights bound by traditional corporate structures.
So it's still very much tied to the old world.
Very much so.
Yeah.
The source text makes it abundantly clear. Investor rights in tokenized property refer to specific, rigid parameters set out in contracts, platform terms, and, regulatory frameworks.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, we're talking about navigating a highly structured legal environment where the token is basically merely the ultimate byproduct of a massive paper trail.
Which brings us to, I think, the most misunderstood concept in this entire ecosystem.
Co-ownership itself.
Exactly. Ownership. So if you buy a token, do you actually own the physical building? Let's make this tangible for you guys listening. If I hold a token that supposedly represents a beautiful apartment building downtown, can I just show up on a Saturday morning with a bucket of paint and like go paint the front door?
You cannot touch the front door.
I can't.
No, in fact, you legally have absolutely no direct relationship with that front door.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, buying property tokens does not mean owning the physical property directly in your name. I mean, the local land registry does not know who you are.
Right.
And they frankly do not care how many tokens sit in your digital wallet.
That reminds me of the stock market, actually.
How so?
Well, buying a property token feels a lot like buying a share of Apple stock.
Okay, yeah.
You know, you own an economic interest in the Apple Corporation, but you can't just walk into your local Apple store,
Yeah.
point to a new iPhone on the display table, and say, I'm taking this. I own a piece of this company.
Right, they'd call security.
Exactly.
The Apple analogy is close, but here's where it kind of breaks down and where the underlying mechanism of tokenization becomes really important. Apple is a massive, active operating corporation, right, with employees and product lines.
Yeah.
In tokenized real estate, the architecture relies on what is essentially an empty legal wrapper.
An empty wrapper.
Yeah, usually it's called a special purpose vehicle or an SPV.
Okay, an SPV.
Right, and the SPV is a passive entity created for one single reason, to hold the physical title deed of that specific property.
Oh, I get it.
So the blockchain tokens you hold are simply programmable shares of that specific SPV.
Wait, so the entity is the official owner on the government books, and I just own a piece of the entity.
That is the crucial distinction. The SPV owns the bricks. You own a contractual right linked to the SPV.
Wow, okay.
And understanding why the industry had to evolve this way is key. I mean, think of local real estate law as like a legacy mainframe computer.
Right, super old and clunky.
Exactly. It is incredibly old, slow, and hyper-localized. It is practically impossible to connect that legacy system directly to the fast-moving, borderless modern internet.
That makes sense.
If a tokenization platform tried to put 10,000 individual, fluctuating pseudonymous names on a single physical property deed at a local county clerk's office,
Oh man, the system would completely break.
it would break instantly. The land registry would reject it outright.
So the legal entity, this SPV holding the deed, it acts almost like a legal API.
I like that.
Like the blockchain talks to the API and the SPV talks to the local government. You can only do what the API's legal terms allow you to do.
That is a much more accurate way to look at it. The SPV acts as a bridge between the rigid local property registrar and, global liquidity.
Okay.
By using an entity to hold the single physical deed and then tokenizing the shares of that entity, you allow for mass fractional participation.
So you get the best of both worlds.
Right. You get the speed of the blockchain while keeping the property fully compliant with slow-moving local real estate laws.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
You have a contractual right to income, a proportional economic interest in the asset's value, and defined transfer rights.
But I can't paint the door.
Exactly. What you absolutely do not have is personal title registration or direct control over the physical asset.
Okay, so if I don't own the physical bricks and I'm just holding an economic right to the SPV that does own the bricks, we need to look at what exactly I'm getting an economic right to.
Right, the financial side.
Because if I can't live in the building or change the carpet, the obvious answer is cash flow.
Yeah. Income entitlement is arguably the primary driver for investor participation here.
Makes sense.
The source notes that the vast majority of investors engage with these platforms because they expect a share of the recurring rental income, or, you know, the eventual profits from a sale.
Not just theoretical exposure to the property's value.
Exactly. Not just illiquid exposure. They want the yield.
But let me push back on this a bit, because there is this massive assumption floating around the crypto space.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
Right. Like, because this entire system is built on blockchain architecture, doesn't that mean my returns are guaranteed by the code?
No, definitely not.
But isn't the whole point of a smart contract that it automatically, like, beams rent into my wallet on the first of every month, risk-free, without a middleman interfering?
Yeah, that is perhaps the most dangerous misconception in the tokenized property space.
Wait, really?
Absolutely. Tokens do not, and mathematically cannot, promise fixed or risk-free returns.
Interesting.
I mean, the technology might automate the final delivery of the funds, but a smart contract cannot invent money that doesn't exist in the real world.
Right. If the tenant doesn't pay, there's no money.
Exactly. The source provides a very detailed breakdown of this waterfall mechanism.
Okay.
And this waterfall dictates how income distribution actually flows in these structures.
Right. The waterfall. Let's trace a dollar for the listener from the tenant paying rent all the way to the token holder's digital wallet.
Okay, it starts entirely off-chain. Step one, the physical tenants pay their rent in fiat currency to the property entity, the SPV.
So they don't pay me directly?
No, they don't pay you and they don't interact with the blockchain at all.
Got it.
They write a normal check or make a bank transfer to the entity that holds the deed.
Which means if the tenant stops paying, the blockchain doesn't magically generate yield out of thin air.
Right. The flow stops right there.
Wow.
But assuming the rent is paid, we move to step two, which is where the realities of real estate really hit hard.
The expenses.
Exactly.
Hmm.
Costs are deducted from that gross rent pool. You have to pay the off-chain property management company, the local property taxes, the insurance premiums, and the maintenance costs.
Ah, the dreaded broken boiler.
Yes, the boiler.
Like if the boiler breaks in the middle of winter, a plumber needs to be paid in real fiat currency immediately.
Right, and the SPV has to pay that plumber out of the collected rent.
Before I see a dime.
Exactly. Which brings us to step three, calculating the net income.
Okay.
This is whatever fiat currency is actually left over in the SPV's traditional bank account after all the physical world bills are paid.
And then
finally, in step four, that remaining net income is converted or bridged onto the blockchain and distributed by the smart contract to the token holders proportionally.
So the vulnerability here for you, the listener, is massive if you aren't paying attention to the fine print.
Very much so.
The vulnerabilities are the exact same as any traditional real estate investment.
Yeah.
Vacancy periods, unexpected massive repairs, general market downturns. Plus, you have to factor in the platform fees for maintaining the SPV and the blockchain infrastructure.
Okay, those platform fees add up.
Right. And all of that eats into the gross rent before the smart contract even wakes up to distribute your share.
Your contractual right is exclusively to the net income when it actually exists.
Not gross. Net.
It is absolutely not a guaranteed yield.
Yeah.
I mean, if the building sits empty for 6 months or the roof collapses and requires a total replacement.
Then what?
Then the smart contract will automatically and efficiently distribute exactly $0. The investor rights protect your proportional access to the income pool, but they offer zero shield against the brutal realities of physical property management.
Wait, if my income is constantly being eaten by off-chain platform fees and unexpected boiler repairs, and my rights are just tied up in an SPV,
yeah.
Why wouldn't I just buy a traditional real estate investment trust? Like, why wouldn't I just buy a REIT stock through my regular brokerage?
It's a fair question.
It sounds like we are layering incredibly complex cryptographic technology over traditional real estate just for the sake of a buzzword.
It is a valid critique, and it forces us to look at the specific frictions traditional REITs present.
Okay.
REITs generally offer broad portfolio exposure, right? You are buying a blended fraction of hundreds of malls or office buildings.
Sure.
Tokenization allows for a granular, targeted, fractional ownership of a single specific asset anywhere in the globe.
So I can pick the exact building.
Exactly. Yeah. Furthermore, traditional REITs or private syndications often have high financial barriers to entry, accredited investor requirements, or multi-year lockup periods.
Right. Your money is stuck.
The tokenized SPV model theoretically lowers the capital entry point and provides a secondary market for liquidity that a private real estate syndicate simply cannot offer.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting.
Okay.
If I am the one taking on the ultimate financial risk of that broken boiler or a vacant unit, my immediate reaction is that I want the power to fire the property manager who let the boiler degrade in the first place.
Of course you do.
Right. So how does this system handle governance? How do thousands of micro-owners scattered across the globe suddenly demand a say in physical operations?
Well, to avoid the too many cooks in the kitchen problem, platforms usually default to a dictatorship.
A dictatorship? That sounds terrible on paper. I'm putting up the capital, but I have absolutely zero voice in how the capital is managed.
It sounds restrictive, but the source explains that this is a deliberate structural necessity.
Really? Why?
The alternative is operational paralysis. Where if you need a decentralized consensus vote from thousands of anonymous token holders just to approve a routine carpet replacement in the hallway, the building will fall into disrepair.
Okay, yeah, that would take forever.
The platforms prioritize operational efficiency over democratic investor participation.
That makes sense.
The source actually outlines three distinct structural approaches to governance that investors need to look for in the documentation.
Okay, so the first is the total dictatorship, no voting rights at all. The SPV manager makes every operational and financial decision.
Correct. You are purely a silent economic partner.
Got it.
But there's a middle ground for massive structural events, and that is the second approach, limited voting rights.
How does that work?
In this scenario, day-to-day operations are handled by the manager, but the SPV cannot execute a major pivot without token holder approval.
Like what kind of pivot?
We were talking about irreversible events like liquidating the entire property, taking on massive new debt, or totally restructuring the SPV.
Okay, that makes practical sense. I don't care about the hallway carpet, but if you're going to sell the building out from under me, I definitely want to say.
Exactly.
And what is the third approach?
Advisory voting.
Advisory.
Yeah, this is where token holders are permitted to vote on broader operational issues, like changing the property management firm or suggesting a renovation. But the outcome of the vote does not legally bind the SPV manager.
Wait, so it's just a suggestion box?
Basically, it acts as a highly visible temperature check of investor sentiment, but the manager retains the final fiduciary authority to just ignore the vote if they deem it detrimental to the asset.
So 90% of the token holders could vote to paint the building pink, and the manager can just say, noted, but no, we are keeping it gray.
Exactly. And the source points to a platform called Osul Gamma to illustrate how this is handled in practice.
Okay, Osul Gamma.
Yeah, and the platform isn't highlighted because they offer some utopian, fully decentralized, autonomous organization to run an apartment building. They are highlighted because their documentation explicitly and transparently maps out the limits of investor authority.
So you know what you're getting into.
Right. Knowing exactly where your power ends and the manager's power begins is the real protection here. A transparent dictatorship is far safer than a convoluted structure that falsely promises decentralized governance but fails to execute in the real world.
But, that transparency brings up a really crucial tension.
What's that?
If my governance is legally restricted and I am essentially a silent partner hoping the SPV manages the physical property competently off-chain, what happens when things go disastrously wrong?
Yeah, that's the big question.
Like, who protects me if the dictator goes rogue?
This raises an important question about the fundamental limits of the technology itself.
Right, because we are talking about blockchains, cryptographic proofs, and immutable smart contracts.
Yes.
It is incredibly easy to fall into the trap of thinking that the technology itself is the ultimate protection, that the immutable ledger is my definitive shield against fraud, embezzlement, or catastrophic mismanagement.
The source categorically refutes the idea that technology alone can protect an investor in this space.
Wow, really?
Yeah, it delivers a stark reality check. Quote, enforcement depends on courts, not code.
Courts, not code. That is a massive paradigm shift for a demographic that usually operates under the strict philosophy that code is law.
It is the single most critical legal distinction in tokenized real estate.
Hmm.
I mean, the phrase code is law works beautifully if you are trading purely digital assets, like a decentralized stablecoin.
Right, where everything lives on the network.
But the moment you tie a digital token to a physical piece of concrete anchored in a specific geographic jurisdiction, the code becomes subservient to the local law.
That makes total sense.
The blockchain is an unparalleled tool for transparency. It maintains a permanent, mathematically verifiable record of who holds what economic right to the SPV. But legal documents are the absolute foundation.
Let's play this out. Say a platform manager decides to act fraudulently.
Okay.
They collect the fiat rent from the tenants, but instead of depositing it into the SPV's bank account to be bridged to the smart contract, they just wire it to an offshore account and disappear.
Right, a classic exit scam.
Exactly. A smart contract can instantly freeze the tokens on the blockchain, but that doesn't magically recover the stolen fiat currency.
No, it doesn't. The smart contract is powerless off-chain. You cannot program a piece of code to arrest an embezzler or force the physical liquidation of a building.
So what do you do?
To recover your capital, you have to step entirely outside the blockchain ecosystem. You have to hire real-world lawyers, go to a physical court in the jurisdiction where the SPV is registered, and initiate a traditional lawsuit.
So if I buy a token for a property located in a country with a notoriously weak, corrupt, or sluggish legal system for investor protection,
yeah.
The fact that my token is secured by the Ethereum network means absolutely nothing.
Nothing at all.
The local jurisdiction is what fundamentally dictates the enforceability of my rights.
The jurisdiction is everything.
Okay.
This is why the source emphasizes that your rights do not originate from the blockchain architecture.
Like it does.
No, they originate from the offering memorandums, the shareholder agreements, the platform's terms of service, and the overarching local securities regulation.
Little paperwork.
Right. If the foundational legal framework of the SPV is poorly drafted, or if the property is located in a jurisdiction that doesn't respect corporate veils, the most advanced cryptographic security in the world will not protect your investment.
Wow.
Documentation matters far more than the technology.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? We've peeled back the layers of SPV wrappers. We've broken down the realities of the net income waterfall. We've explored the deliberate restrictions on governance. And we've established that when things go wrong, you are relying on slow, expensive, real-world courts rather than instant code.
It's a lot to take in.
It begs the question, who is this highly abstracted, legally complex model actually built for?
Well, the source is quite explicit that this architecture rewards informed, methodical participation, and it severely punishes assumptions.
So you can't just dive in blindly.
Definitely not.
Yeah.
Based on the structures we've analyzed, there are very distinct profiles of who should be running toward this space and who should be running away.
Let's synthesize who should run away.
Okay, let's hear.
If you are a control enthusiast, someone who wants to vet the tenants, pick the paint colors, and physically inspect the boiler, this indirect SPV-mediated model will absolutely drive you crazy.
Oh, without a doubt.
Secondly, if you are a crypto purist who believes that smart contracts negate the need for lawyers and you completely refuse to read a 50-page offering memorandum, you are going to get burned.
Yes. Furthermore, anyone still clinging to the illusion that a token is a digital title deed needs to step back immediately.
Definitely.
But for those who actually understand the SPV architecture, the source identifies four key profiles that actively benefit from this setup.
Okay, let's go through them. Who's first?
First, you have native crypto investors who have generated massive wealth on-chain but are looking to diversify into real, structured, inflation-resistant physical assets without converting everything back through traditional banking bottlenecks.
Oh, that's smart. And the second profile?
Traditional investors exploring fractional ownership.
Okay.
These are people who want exposure to real estate yields, but they fundamentally do not want the physical liability.
They don't want the midnight phone calls.
Right. They are perfectly happy trading control for convenience. They willingly accept the platform fees and the lack of voting rights because they simply do not want to be the one taking a phone call about a broken pipe at 2 a.m.
Right. They're buying the net income, fully aware of the gross expenses.
Okay. So
what's the third profile?
Third, We have professional investors who prioritize defined legal risk over speculative hype.
Okay.
They are looking for the boring, predictable legal enforceability of a registered SPV, rather than gambling on unregulated, highly volatile digital assets.
Which brings us to the fourth profile.
And the fourth profile is perhaps the most transformative, the cross-border investor.
Oh, this is fascinating.
Let's look at the traditional friction here. If a foreign investor wants to buy a physical apartment in another country, they usually have to hire a local real estate attorney, fly in to open a foreign bank account, navigate complex international tax withholding laws, and, you know, try to understand an entirely unfamiliar local market.
Right. It is a massive barrier to entry. It usually limits international real estate to ultra-high net worth individuals or huge institutional funds.
But tokenization abstracts all of that local friction away.
Because of the SPV?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The SPV, the legal API we discussed earlier, is already set up by the platform.
Wow.
It handles the local property law compliance, the municipal taxes, and the physical management.
Everything is handled.
Everything. The cross-border investor simply buys the standardized, globally accessible token representing an economic right to that SPV.
So they are basically outsourcing the local legal and operational headaches to the SPV manager.
Exactly.
For them, the heavily structured indirect ownership model isn't a drawback. It is the exact feature that makes the investment possible in the first place.
You nailed it. It allows global capital to flow into hyper-local physical assets with the friction of an internet transaction, but only because that massive underlying legal architecture is supporting it off-chain.
So to bring this all together, tokenized property is a legitimate, legally defined asset class, but it requires an entirely new framework for how we think about real estate.
Yes, it really does.
You're not buying physical bricks. You are buying programmable contractual rights linked to a specialized entity.
Which means your due diligence cannot be limited to analyzing the neighborhood or the building's aesthetic.
Right, you can't just look at photos of the lobby.
No, you must interrogate the legal architecture. You have to read the offering memorandum, understand the exact governance limitations, trace the income waterfall, and critically evaluate the real-world jurisdiction where the SPV is anchored.
It's a lot of homework.
It is. The blockchain delivers unprecedented transparency, but your actual financial safety relies entirely on traditional legal compliance.
It is a phenomenal evolution in how we structure capital, but it basically demands an evolution in investor literacy. We have to stop looking for our names on local municipal deeds and start analyzing corporate shareholder agreements.
Well said. And, you know, if we connect all of these technical and legal mechanisms to the bigger picture, it leaves us with a rather profound sociological implication to consider.
Oh, wow. Lay it on us.
Well, if the tokenized SPV architecture functions exactly as designed, allowing anyone, anywhere in the world, to frictionlessly purchase the economic rights to the real estate in your specific neighborhood without ever needing to step foot in the country, what happens to the very concept of a local community?
Oh, that's heavy.
Right. When the financial benefits, the rental yields, and the property appreciation of our cities are entirely disconnected from the people who actually live, work, and sleep in those buildings, how does that change the fabric of a neighborhood?
That is a staggering thought. It really forces us to ask if the physical buildings surrounding us are destined to become nothing more than abstracted financial instruments for a decentralized global network.
It's a real possibility.
Yeah. And that is exactly the kind of deep systemic question we hope you, the listener, keep mulling over long after this discussion ends. We encourage you to keep digging into the source material because the collision between immutable code and local concrete is only going to become more intricately woven. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.